You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number four best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk can be supported by listeners like you at patreon.com/monstertalk or by leaving positive reviews on iTunes and other podcasting sites. Learn more at monstertalk.org/support. Thanks to all of you who are supporting us in this way. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or exceed your expectations.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Pat Spain is an adventurer, a wildlife biologist, a TV presenter, and now is the author of several new books based on his many exciting experiences hunting for monsters. On the Nat Geo series Beast Hunter, Pat looked for creatures like the Mapinguari and the Orang Pendak and many other mystery creatures that we've talked about on the show. I got a chance to read two of Pat's new books, and I think they'll likely be right up the alley of most of our audience. I hope that we've always been consistent on Monster Talk, that despite our skepticism about most cryptids being real animals, we do applaud serious investigations and field work that look into these stories. Pat's done just that, and along the way he's got many experience points and tons of stories to share, and he was very fun to talk to. So let's get right into the
Monster Talk.
Tonight we're talking with Pat Spain, who is host of the old Nat Geo cryptozoology adventure series Beast Hunter, and he's now the author of six new books, and we'll hear more about that shortly. But to be clear, he is not Mark Singer, so we will be tossing out all our questions about working with Kodo and Podo. So,
very good.
Welcome to Monster Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was wondering, who am I staring? You put a picture of this Mark Singer guy into the dock. I'm like, who the hell is this?
I was trying to find one with where he had clothes on. It's so hard. He does. If I was in that good of shape, I probably wouldn't on a shirt either.
Thank you for joining us. We want to talk about your new books, but we'd like to start by asking you a little about your TV shows.
Sure, and absolutely.
So I've checked out some of these and they're good fun. And I'm wondering, if you could just tell us a bit about the shows that you've done in the past, and I want to ask you about a particularly memorable scene, too.
Sure, definitely. So I've been doing TV since back in 2003. I started with Animal Planet, and I did a reality show called King of the Jungle 2, and that got me my first taste of wildlife, you know, filmmaking. And it was something I'd always wanted to do since I was a little kid. I've been giving these talks when I'd catch every animal I could get my hands on. And when you're the crazy guy standing in the field, you know, holding a rattlesnake, you tend to get a crowd gathered around you. And at the time, you know, the biggest audience that I could reach with this kind of enthusiasm for wildlife felt like TV. So way back in 2003, so I did this reality show on Animal Planet. Then I started filming my own web-based nature show called Nature Calls, and I put it up on YouTube. And I did that for about 6 years, and then I got a few pilots here and there for Animal Planet and for Sci-Fi and for a couple other networks. And then finally, this show with Nat Geo hit called Beast Hunter. And I did a season of that, and then I did some stuff for BBC again, back to Sci-Fi, and then a series for Travel Channel called Legend Hunter. And then the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
So then I wrote some books.
Some books, yeah, 6 books in total.
Yeah, nice use of your free time, yeah.
Yeah, I did not start planning to write 6 books, but sometimes that happens, I guess.
That's an incredible feat. So congratulations on that. And I just wanted to ask you about the memorable scene, which is doing the rounds on YouTube still, and that is the scene with the gloves that you wore with the venomous bullet ants. So if you could tell us a little bit about that, which you do cover in one of your books too.
Yes, absolutely. So the funny thing about that is, it was my idea, first of all. So this was, I had to convince the production company to allow me to do it. We had to go through health and safety meetings. I had to get it cleared. I had to sign my life away a number of times, and still they weren't going to let me do it. But it was the only way that I felt that I could really show this tribe, the Satere Moe, who I wanted to hear their stories about the Mapinguari. And they're rightfully hesitant to share any of their, you know, their truth, their stories with outsiders. They haven't been treated very well by the West, as many, many indigenous peoples could share that kind of experience. So I thought the only way that I could really gain their trust was to do something extreme to show them that I respected their culture and that I could be trusted with their stories. And it seemed like the bullet ants was going to be the way to do that. So when I brought it up, the production company was very, very against it. But after a lot of convincing, a lot of paperwork, finally I was able to do it. And oh man, it was to say it was life changing is an understatement. I now have a bullet ant tattoo, and I kind of link it back to. So, I mean, it really taught me exactly what your body can go through. Just what the most awful thing that you can possibly experience, you know, physically that your body can really handle. That was the bullet ants. And right before we filmed it, the producer looked at me and he said, "Pat, this is the scene that everyone's going to remember." And he wasn't wrong.
Oh boy, everything's a breeze after that.
That's right.
What is the purpose of the ritual within the tribal community outside of, you know, I know obviously for us, it might be a feat of manhood or endurance or something, but what is it within the tribe? Like, why do they do it?
Sure. Yeah. So it's if you want to be a hunter. And a hunter is the highest position in their society. So in order to be a hunter, you have to do this ritual 20 times. And it's
I'm sorry, what?
Yes, 20 times. 20. So it's a way to really like prove yourself, to prove your dedication to your community, and also to show you what you can go through, because they're in a pretty harsh environment in this part of Brazil, in the rainforest. And if you're out on a hunt and you fall off a cliff or fall out of a tree or get gored by a pig that you're hunting, you may think, this is the worst pain I've ever been in, and I'm just going to lay down and die, unless you've done the bullet ants 20 times, in which case you're going to go, I'm going to walk back to the village.
Wow.
You've got 19 times to go.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, I am very – and the funny thing is I met I met quite a few people in the village who had done it once or twice and said, nope, I don't need to be a hunter. That's okay.
Yeah.
Really? Wow. That's incredible.
The venom of those ants is designed to make you never want to hurt one again or that's encounter exactly one. It. And so, I know sometimes you get stung by a bee once and you're fine, but the next time you have a terrible allergic reaction. So does this ritual kill people sometimes?
Yes. So the ritual can potentially kill you, and there's two different ways that it could. One is anaphylaxis, as you said, just like the like a bee, and that it's completely random. So I didn't used to be allergic to poison ivy. I could take poison ivy and rub it all over my face and nothing would happen. Now I'm allergic to poison ivy. So your allergies can change very quickly. And that's one of the things that really concerned the production company about this was even though I've never shown any, you know, I've never shown any allergy. I've been stung and bitten by just about everything you can think of. There's still no way to tell whether that I will experience this later. And the other way that it kills people is just from the pain. Your body can go into shock just from being put in that much trauma and that much pain. And there have been people who have been, usually it's when they're surprised, when they don't know that they're going to be stung and then suddenly they are, but people have died just from that shock.
Yeah, it's very compelling video, but the way you wrote it up in the Map and Gwari book is even deeper and more interesting. I like that. So,
thank you very much.
Very
thank
brave.
You. Thank you. Thank you. It's, brave is not the word that many people use for it. Not, certainly not the word my wife used.
It's another brief word, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, there are other words, but we'll go with brave.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Pat, you really do remind me of Steve Irwin in many ways.
Yes, no, that is the greatest compliment that anyone could possibly pay me. Steve Irwin is absolutely a hero of mine and has been since I first saw his shows and followed his career as closely as anyone, I think, who didn't know him personally. But everyone I know who's worked with him just has nothing but amazing things to say about him. Everyone's got a Steve anecdote or a story or something, and no one has ever said a bad word about him. I know guys that used to supply him with animals for talk shows, and I know people that worked on his crew and people who just kind of met him in the industry, and everyone loved him, and oh man, he was the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a good guy, and I do see the similarities, and I wanted to ask you, what was your closest call with a dangerous animal, or are we talking about the bullet ants there?
Well, I've been bitten and stung by so much. I was bitten by a neotropical rattlesnake once, and that is a really nasty. Yeah, that's a really, really bad venom. It's a mix of hemotoxic and neurotoxic. Luckily, it was a dry bite. So about 25% of the time that rattlesnakes bite, they don't inject any venom. It's just a warning, like, hey, why are you picking me up kind of thing? And I learned my lesson from it. So I promised my family that I would never free handle again after that. But I'd say a rabid raccoon was the worst bite I've ever had, because that's the one that definitely would have killed me without medical intervention.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, we're dealing with raccoons at the moment here in our house. They're getting on the roof and the roofs of neighbors as well. So
sorry.
My ears just pricked up at that.
yeah.
They can be pretty vicious.
They can, and they make the weirdest noises. They sound like aliens. They're just very strange animals. But the attack by one was not fun. And all of the shots that followed and the, you know, months of shots. And yeah, it was pretty wild. But that was the most dangerous, because I think there's only been one person in history who's ever survived rabies. And they were pretty bad off, even though they did survive. So that one was scary.
Pat just dropped some science news candy there, and I wanted to take a second to highlight it. In 2004, 15-year-old Gina Giese was rescuing a bat that she had found in her church, and it bit her. She didn't seek treatment immediately, and when she got sick a few weeks later, it turned out to be rabies. Up until this very moment in history, rabies had been a 100% guaranteed death sentence. The doctor team at her Wisconsin hospital put her into a medically induced coma and began a cocktail of drug treatments to fight the infection. It took 75 days, and after the treatment, she had to learn to walk and talk again, but she survived. Not only that, but she went on to finish high school and graduate college, and in 2016, she gave birth to twins. Now she has three kids, a husband, and what sounds like a very full life. Dubbed the Milwaukee Protocol, this incredible procedure has given hope to people who otherwise would certainly have died of rabies. Since her amazing recovery, at least 10 other people around the world have averted death by rabies through this challenging and difficult procedure. But this is a good reminder that if you get bit by a wild animal that's behaving oddly, it is much safer to seek rabies treatment immediately. Back to the show. Yikes. Yeah, no. And I've watched some of the old medical rabies movies where they didn't really have any cure, and they're just going through the stages of as these people lose their coherent identity and the ability to talk and all the different things that happen. Oh, it's really horrible.
Oh, it's awful.
Tragic.
Yeah. Mm.
Awful. It was such a terrifying disease to everyone. It was just one of those, you can kind of understand as a kid watching Old Yeller is awful and scarring and horrific. But now as an adult, you look back on it.
You know, the way it changes the animal's behavior in the later stages is also, it's uncanny. It's like, you don't expect deer to be aggressive or for animals to just that would normally run away to come charging at
you. Squirrel.
Yeah. It's quite disturbing.
Yeah. Oh, thanks to Louis Pasteur.
Yeah.
That's right. For so many things. But yes, for that as well.
And beer. So people forget how much Louis Pasteur protected our beer. Let me ask this. Oh, in reading your book, I mean, obviously, the topic of monsters and biology and overlaps of science are right up our alley. But one of the things that I thought kind of surprised me, and maybe it shouldn't have because it's Nat Geo, but Karen and I have had some experience doing talking head jobs on TV shows. But you talked about part of the crew at Nat Geo included, how does this pronounce? Fact check. Is that right? Fact check. What's that?
I know. That's one of the things. So Nat Geo was absolutely my dream job. That was the goal all along. Ever since I started doing wildlife stuff, I wanted to do it for Nat Geo. And one of the reasons is because of just what an amazingly well-respected organization they are. And they lived up to everything that I had ever heard about them. So doing a show about cryptozoology on Nat Geo carries with it some challenges, as you can imagine. There's nothing fake about the shows on that whatsoever. And anything that I said had to be backed up by peer or expert reviewed sources. So there was a few things that I said. I went to school for marine biology. I did, a whole bunch of marine biology work, and they wouldn't accept me as an expert in marine biology to make my own statements.
Wow.
And I loved that. I thought that was great because it really, really challenged us and made us, I felt like the entire show made it so much better because we couldn't cut corners and we couldn't get away with saying things that were, even a hint of not being true.
Impressive.
It was a lot of fun. It made the editor's job a little trickier, but
yeah.
No, it's the right thing to do, and we haven't always seen that with other networks.
Indeed.
Oh, for sure. Just TV in general. I mean, everything tends to be sensationalized and that sort of thing, and I just loved the fact that they really, really allowed the production company and I to do what we felt was right. And, not only allowed us, but that's what they wanted. And that was really the great thing was, we couldn't get away with any kind of trickery.
Fantastic. Very, very impressive. So let's move on and start talking about your books. And
thank you.
I don't know where to begin. I mean, you've got 6 books. I think perhaps I'll ask you first about the one that I was not familiar with, and that's the Manitoba 200,000 Snakes and Cancer. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure, absolutely. So the 5 books, 5 out of the 6 make sense. I think that, there's 5 books that are all about a different location, and they're kind of darkly funny travel stories from these locations, all centered around a cryptid. Right. And then there's the 6th book that's the 200,000 Snakes in Manitoba, and it's all and cancer. And it's kind of the bridge is the way that the production company described it. So when I had originally written these books, it was one book. And it was about 800 pages long. And the publisher said, that's way too long. And I said, I know, that's much too big. And they said, okay, we're going to have to cut this back. And as we got into the process of cutting it back, they said, actually, instead of cutting it back, could you write more? And we're going to make this 6 books. And I said, sure.
Wow.
So we separated it out and cut it out. And a theme throughout all of the books was my experience with cancer, because right after filming Beast Hunter, I was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer. And I drew on a lot of the things that I learned in Beast Hunter to survive it, to really come out of it, you know, physically and mentally okay. I won't say perfect, but I came out of it okay. And that was a huge part due to Beast Hunter. So this was a running theme throughout the book. So what the publishers asked me to do was to take all of that stuff out and put it into one book and write just the whole story around that. So what actually happened is after this diagnosis and after spending months in the hospital and a year of chemo and a year recovering, when I finally started to feel human again, I wanted to prove to myself that I still was Pat Spain. I still could do these adventures and I could do this stuff. So I convinced a couple of buddies of mine to drive 34 hours up to Manitoba, Canada, and lay down in the largest concentration of snakes on Earth. Lay down in a pit with the largest concentration of snakes on Earth and film it for YouTube.
Wow.
So do anything.
Yeah. I mean, that was my questionable coping mechanism was to deal with cancer, was to lay down in a huge pit of snakes. I was misdiagnosed for like 8 months or more.
Yikes. With
just everything you can think of.
IBS, I mean, something.
Oh yeah, IBS and gluten allergy and potentially this, right. And let's try that. And maybe you picked up a parasite. And I did pick up a couple parasites. Right. So it was...
Yeah, that was a good theory, though, with everything you've gone through.
Yeah. So it was really like, I don't fault the doctors at all. I mean, it was an amazing team that you know, did this. And I was 30 years
so
old
young
and otherwise healthy. Yeah. So they finally did figure it out after a colonoscopy. And it was just, I mean, it was like nothing that I ever expected. And I don't think it really hit me, actually, until after the surgery and until all of the issues that followed. You know, after I had the surgery, then I ended up having a secondary infection where they had to put me in an induced coma and open me up from the sternum to the just totally exposed, up and flush me out for days. And that was really where all the problems came from. So
with the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's all behind you now.
It is, yeah, literally and figuratively, right?
No puns, Blake. No puns.
I'm sorry.
No. The doctors, the funny thing is, there is a lot that's funny about it. Like, it's just, it's awful. It was the worst thing that could ever happen to a person, but there are things that are objectively funny. And one of them is the doctor would come in every day and ask you to rate your pain, you know, multiple times a day. They'd say, what's your pain on a level of 1 to 10? And, you know, they told me after I was in there for about a month and I was finally feeling a little bit more, you know, I could talk. And they said, you know, you're our only patient who never gave themselves a 10. They said, we would see you writhing in agony, barely able to speak, like you'd hold up fingers to say what your pain level was, and you only gave yourself a 9 a couple times. And I said, yeah, that's because I felt a 10. Right. I know what a 10 is. Yeah, yeah.
Outside of that.
So if you're ever wondering, bullet answer a 10, having your intestines rupture and go septic is a 9.
Wow. Wow. Oh,
you poor thing.
Well, but still, why were there 200,000 snakes in Canada? What's going on?
So, it's the largest concentration of snakes on Earth for a number of reasons. So it's about as far north. These are red-sided garter snakes, and it's about the furthest north that their range is. So this is about the coldest that they will live. So, yeah. Garter snakes in general have a survival strategy over the winter to den together underground. And around here in Massachusetts and in other parts of the U.S., you'll get, you know, maybe 20 of them, maybe like 10 to 20 will den together. But as you get further north, the dens might get a little bit larger. Well, up in Manitoba, the dens get huge because it gives everything that they need. So by those large numbers, they get a little bit of warmth just from body heat.
Right.
So it can help them to survive that way. There's also limestone dens just underground that are below the frost line, and the holes are only big enough for snakes to get in, not any predator.
Wow.
So they can get down there and survive. And when they come out, when they first emerge in the spring, there's mates all nearby. So they're looking to mate, and they've all been denning together. So they're right there. They have the opportunity to mate. And there's a ton of food sources very close. After the winter, they're all hungry. They want to eat right away. So all of these factors combined just make it so that all of the snakes within about a 10-mile radius just all come together into this one spot. And it's this one like very small little pit where they all just congregate.
And you just walk in and lie down, or?
Yeah, so I got special permission from the Canadian government to do this, and I told them the idea, and they said anything that'll bring more publicity to this, we're all for. We think this would be great, because even people who live, you know, 15, 20 miles away from it have never heard of it. They don't know that this is there. It's not exactly a tourist slogan. You can't buy magnets and stuff for the snake dens, even though it is one of their national parks. But every May, these snakes just emerge in these massive numbers. And for about 2 weeks, they hang around in these den sites, and they go back underground at night, and then they come out in the daytime, then they go back underground, and then eventually they disperse across, you know, however many miles.
Do they call this area the Garter Belt?
Oh, that's a good one. That's what garter snakes are named after, right, is garter belts. But they the Narcisse snake dens are the place, and I'd read about them when I was a kid, and it was something I always wanted to do, and just decided that was going to be it. That was how I would teach myself that I was back and I could still, you know, be this crazy adventurer.
You have an impressive bucket list of things.
I have a strange bucket list. I do. I have a list of goal species that I want to see, and I check them off as I find them. And, you know, it's I found one dead, I got to play with one, or I saw one in captivity.
Well, I have to say, okay, again, I've only read two of these, so I can only speak to 33% of your work. But I think, first of all, your writing is very easy to read and funny. But I like your – okay, you're going to appeal to a lot of our audience, because we're a very skeptical show that likes to use monsters as a way to talk about science. But, you know, I think even though I'm super skeptical about a lot of these monsters existing, I absolutely endorse having a look. I mean, it would be very, very armchair skeptic to just go, nah, that's not real, without actually doing the work. So I appreciate anybody who's able to go out and actually – try to see if these things exist, even in the service of a television show. It's good because it raises awareness and it gets to talk about some of the stories behind these creatures. So I think your approach is great, and will appeal to a lot of our listeners.
Thank you so much. That really is the approach. It really is. It's even Beast Hunter was never looking to prove whether the animal was real or not. It was looking to show, you know, the story of the place and what this animal means to the indigenous people who live there, and what are the stories, you know, reminiscent of, what are they teaching us? What can, and what else can we find about this region? And I loved that approach. And that is exactly what I took away from all of it. And I think that it really comes to Darren Naish has a great quote where he talks about cryptozoology as being part biology and part anthropology. And that's absolutely how I approach it as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Fantastic.
Darren's a longtime friend of the show. He was one of our early guests.
And, best guests.
Yep.
So. He's awesome. He's such a good guy.
A lot of fun. I think the first time he was on, he didn't know how much punning I like to do. So I think I caught him a little off guard. But after that, it was great.
Very good.
He forgave us.
He did. 2022, I think one of our themes has been how much can I talk about animal junk? So like this was the year that I learned that roosters don't have penises. So it's been really life changing. And then we just got finished doing a Candy Roo episode about fish swimming up penises. So
absolutely, yeah. That was something I thought about way too often when I was in the Amazon.
I know
how unlikely this is, but on the very very off chance,
exactly. It is to a certain mind frame a horror story for sure. But I couldn't help but notice that in the Orang Pendek chapter, extensive coverage of its unusually large ratioed penis. So honestly, we don't talk about monster junk enough, do we? So
I would agree.
So
it's one of the distinguishing factors, and it's one of the things that I think is left out of a lot of the witness testimonials and stuff. And I think again, it's the embarrassment factor. It's the luckily I don't get embarrassed about really anything.
Well, is it though? I mean, it could be, but I mean, like if a lot of these creatures are as alleged, like Bigfoot's a hairy primate. Maybe it has like a gorilla style penis where it's not particularly large for its body size. People are often surprised that you can't even tell, I mean, the males have all these other characteristics, but the penis is not one of the ones that really sticks out. So but yeah, so the Orang Pendek apparently, according to the witnesses, has substantial or noticeable external male genitalia.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that really isn't present in the folklore that I've heard. It was really just from the witnesses, and it was something that one of the gentlemen that we were filming with, Jeremy Holden, who's been an extensive researcher, it's something that he came across randomly, I believe, a number of years ago. One of the witnesses very hesitantly told him this, this fact about the external genitalia was much larger than they had expected based on gibbons and orangutans and more human, and especially in the girth, not as much the and the length as well. But so it became something that he would then ask other witnesses, and generally, got the same responses, that this was something where if they had seen a male creature, then they would be able to describe this. And it was with a lot of hemming and hawing and a lot of, embarrassment and I can't believe I'm talking about this type of thing. But yeah, so it became a way to kind of distinguish who potentially really saw a different creature and who is either mistaken or making up a story, was to ask them questions about the external genitalia.
Yeah.
If it was a male that they believed that they had seen, because this is distinct in non-human primates.
The penis as shibboleth. That is so interesting.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and I mean, it is a part of biology. There's quite a bit. I do. I think I talk about barnacles as well in there as having it's six times their own body.
Yep, barnacles and ducks. Yep.
Can you tell us a little bit about your findings with the Mongolian death worm?
So the greatest name in all of cryptozoology, the Mongolian death worm. Who doesn't want to know more about that when you hear that term?
Yes.
That's the one. Someone who knows nothing about cryptozoology, you say, oh yeah, I'm looking for the Mongolian death worm. Like, oh my God, tell me more. And it's a fantastic story. It's the story of the Gobi Desert. I mean, one of the harshest environments on Earth, one of the strangest, most alien landscapes that I've ever seen. Walking around in the Gobi, I look down at my feet and there's a nest of dinosaur eggs, just dinosaur eggs right there on the ground. Like, where else can that possibly happen other than in the Gobi Desert?
Wow.
And it's just the whole story of the Mongolian death worm really just has these amazing parallels with the desert itself. And I never expected to find, you know, this animal that shoots acid out of its mouth and blows itself up and spits hot blood and can electrocute its enemies. But I wanted to see where these stories came from, because when you really break them down, you do find animals that can do all of the things that the death worm is described as doing, just not all in the same creature and not in this region. But as I was living with different nomadic herders and talking to them about the stories, what I found is that every story that they had about the death worm really comes down to don't mess with something that you don't know about, and don't mess with nature for no reason. You know, just don't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's everyone who got hurt by the death worm is someone who poked it with a stick or threw gasoline on it or tried to light it on fire or tried to step on it. Nobody gets hurt just from looking at it. It's not something that, mm-hmm. you know, it's when you see it, just leave it alone. Like, basically the takeaway is just leave them alone. We herd animals.
What's
we
to live
need, by? Right. Yeah. We need the animals that, you know, we love our dogs. We love our goats. We love our sheep. Everything else, just leave it alone.
Yeah. Good takeaway.
Yeah.
It always reminded me of the first of all, it's good to remind listeners, these are small. They're not, you know, sandworms from Dune, you know. But
oh, right. Yeah,
but,
no, they're supposed to be about size of a sheep's stomach. So like 12 inches about at most.
But, you know, things like, you would think, like spitting cobras or, you know, there's so many plausible aspects to explain what seems like nonsense folklore, but you know, you still need to find the real creature to see if it's real, you know? I don't know. It's a fascinating story though. And I bet based on the other two that I looked at that you've got some great travel stories to go with it.
There was definitely some amazing moments about Mongolia, making our own vodka that was fermented from mare's milk.
Mare's milk. Yeah. Yeah. Milk.
So you get this like cheese flavored vodka that's served hot, and we drank quite a bit of it.
Wow.
So there are some good stories from there. And doing traditional Mongolian wrestling is one of my favorite stories of the entire filming experience, because nothing about it went right. Everything that could possibly go wrong did. And it was just hysterical. It was so much fun. I mean, I got absolutely destroyed. I had a giant man just completely, he beat me in about 2 seconds. And then the announcer, this is in front of, you know, I forget how many thousands of people have gathered to watch this spectacle. And the announcer, after I got beaten so badly, they had me come out again. And the announcer says something and the crowd just goes absolutely crazy, laughing hysterically. And I found out later what they said was, the American doesn't think he's done his best, so we're going to have him wrestle a child.
Ow.
I was like, oh, perfect. Perfect.
That's pretty funny.
Oh. Oh, and my wrestle God. A child, I did. And he beat me.
No.
Hardly.
Oh. Oh, boy. Well, I have to read that one next. Then.
Out of your research, what, I guess, not to spoil anything, but what of the creatures do you think is the most plausible?
Caddy, for sure. So the Canadian sea serpent caddy.
That is not what I expected you to say. This, okay, go on.
So there's so much that we don't know about the depth of the ocean. Do I think it's a sea serpent the way that people are describing it with ossicones on top of it? No, I don't. But I do think that I can't think of a single marine biologist that I know personally who would say that we know every animal that lives in the deepest parts of the ocean. There are definitely large animals left to be found there. And it raises the best question in cryptozoology in my mind, and that is, will anyone think of it as caddy? So when we find an animal that meets some of the descriptions, if it doesn't meet all of them, it won't be caddy. It's the kind of Yeti paradox, that if somebody finds a new species of bear that seems to walk more upright and eats moss on certain occasions, so it's venturing higher into the mountains than other bear species and yada, 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 they still won't call it the Yeti, even though it fills that void. It says, yes, this is it. And that's really exciting to biologists. But the general public would still say it's not the Yeti because it's not this, you know, primate species. And that's the same thing with caddy, I think. So I absolutely think it's the most likely that there is something behind it. Not most likely. I'm certain that there's something behind it. But when we do figure out what that is, I think there are very, very few people who will say, yes, that's caddy.
Bold. Yeah.
And do you think that's going to be an undiscovered animal or something like maybe eels or some creature that we know of already?
I think more than likely, because the sightings are all so different. There's probably a number of different animals that are behind all of the sightings. But I think some of the ones that we spoke with, some of the people that we talked to, some of the most likely scenarios for them would be a different species of squid.
Interesting.
With the speed that they talk about it moving, with the way that the neck supposedly comes out of the water, all of that really leads me to think of some type of large squid.
If it turns out to be true, I will be so excited. Honestly, that's the thing. It's like, you know, I'm
keep our eye on this one.
Super skeptical about all these monsters being real, but still, somewhere inside me, the 10-year-old still wants it, real bad to be true.
Definitely. Yeah. Same here, for sure. And that's, Caddy is the kind of easiest because I will be shocked if within the next 10 years we don't find a new species of giant squid. But no one will call it Caddy. And that's kind of the thing that makes it really hard. So of the classic monsters that people think of that you can actually point to something and say, if we find this species, then we can say it is X. I think that the Areng Pendek is very likely. I don't know if there are any left. I think that if there are, they're older individuals that are still kind of barely holding on, but may not be there anymore, but probably died out very recently. And the Mapinguari, I really was shocked to find that there is the chance to have a surviving remnant population of giant ground sloth. I don't know if they would still be there, but I think that far later than we believe ground sloths went extinct, they were still in Amazonia.
It's such a big area. I want it to be true. And I keep, the new study techniques like environmental DNA are providing some really interesting stuff. So it's like, I don't want the Areng Pendek to be extinct if it's real. And if it's real, I hope that they're able to find evidence using, more eDNA studies. I find them more interesting and powerful than camera traps or all the other sort of things people are throwing at these problems. So, again, high skepticism, but equally high hope.
Totally agree. eDNA is the future for all of this research. All the work that's being done with it is absolutely incredible. And it's just a matter of time before we find a lot of new, really cool, exciting things. And Mike Morwood, Dr. Morwood, who is the person who found the hobbit, Homo floresiensis, I was able to meet with him as we were leaving. We were kind of just flying out of Java, and I got a last-minute interview with him, and neither of us were feeling well. We were both sick, which it actually unfortunately turned out both of us were feeling the effects of cancer for the first time.
And
unfortunately, Mike did not survive it. But he was an amazing man, and he told me that he sees no reason why these creatures couldn't have survived up until, the 1920s. And he had some evidence that was not, firm enough to publish, but he did have evidence that there had been survival right up until the 20s.
Wow.
Interesting.
Very.
Pat, I've really enjoyed this interview. You have so many amazing stories to tell and your books are fantastic. I'm definitely a fan. And
thank you so much.
We just want to ask you one final question that we ask all of our guests, and that's, what's your favorite monster?
So my favorite monster, I love it. I would go back to my childhood and say that my favorite is very, very local to upstate New York. There is a lake called Snyder's Lake, and it's a lake monster called Snidey.
Wow.
I was a lifeguard at Snyder's Lake for a large amount of my childhood and spent even more time swimming in there. And it's this story that it must have started, my father was in there in the 50s and he knew the story from then. So it started back, before then. And my grandfather would tell the story from the 20s. So Snidey has been around for a really long time. And it's this supposed giant snapping turtle that terrifies all the kids and stops kids from swimming past the dock. And kind of the biggest feat of strength that you can do is to do the entire lake. Like if you swim all the way across the lake and back, then you're like the ultimate kid, god for a few days. And you've beaten Snidey. So it just brings in all of the best tales about these monsters and lake monsters, and it gives you possible. You know, there probably are big snapping turtles in there. but yeah, so I'd go with Snidey as my favorite monster because that's kind of what got me into a lot of this.
Wow. Well, we just heard about the Beast of Busco. So yeah, giant snapping turtles are our theme. One of our themes for 2022.
Awesome.
taking us out of the year. I was like, wow. Well, I guess technically this will come out in 2023 because this, I think, will be our second episode of the year. But cool. Still, very cool story. Well, golly, so when are these books available? Are they available now? Are they coming out soon? Or when can people get them?
So the six of them are going to be, four are being released on January 1st. And then another one is being released February 1st. And the last one is being released March 1st. And I don't remember which ones are which, but they can all be found on Amazon or at your local bookstore.
Fantastic.
And and people can order them if you just look for Pat Spain. And On the Hunt is the name of the series.
Wow, that's really cool.
There are so many more topics that you can write about. You could just really continue with the series of these beyond six.
That's my goal. Yeah, my goal. I would love to be able to do expeditions, you know, whether it's for TV or not, and just be able to do them and write about them. So
yeah.
I have a few more places that I'd really like to go to. I gotta, when my kids are a little bit older, I'll bring them on a lot of these adventures.
Nice. Are you going to be doing audio versions?
I hope so. So it's something that I spoke with the publisher briefly, but I haven't really delved into. So I would like to do Audible ones.
Yeah.
It's just kind of timing.
Thank you so much.
Right. Well, good luck with the book.
Yeah. Thank you. No, this was great. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And the show is awesome. And I love the skeptical approach and the bringing, using monsters as a kind of intro to buy. I mean, that's all the things that I love and that I wanted to do with all of, you know, with these books and with the shows as well. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for contributing to this field.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us and keep in touch with us too.
Absolutely.
Yes. You guys have a great night.
All right. You too. Good night.
Monster Dog.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You've been listening to an interview with author, TV presenter, biologist, and adventurer Pat Spain. The first four books in Pat's new series are available now, and there's an affiliate link in the show notes that will send a few pennies our way if you buy through clicking that link. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as The Accidental Creative, and The Sit Down. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys, and we really appreciate your making our show a part of your listening life. Thanks.
Been a Monster House presentation.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, the values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number four best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.